announcements, we're not quite ready to officially to be.
But a couple of announcements. First, if you are not on the printed sheet, the printed list of people in the class, it means you're not registered. So if you registered and you're not on that printed sheet, then you kind of have to re-register because something went wrong. So everybody who's sitting in here should either be on that printed sheet or should be registering now by filling out one of those forms completely, please, on the clipboards and then giving it to me. Okay. You know, either that or taking it to the office yourself. The CRN, the course registration number, is 66015. It's also on the top of the registration sheets that are already printed out. But please make sure you're either registered on the printed roster or that you registered today. Also, every time you come to class, please make sure that you check that you have that you are in class, because that's what pays City College for your presence. Question?
You can make some more money and teach another class next semester called How to Sign Up and Register.
Yes. Okay, so, Lisa, this is Lisa Draper, without whom this would not be.
He's better than me. Some of you may or may not know that we have, all the non-credit students have a pipeline email account. All students that are non-credit students have been assigned a pipeline email account, and I don't think that they tell you that when you register. And this is the main way that the instructor communicates with you, unless they collect your emails in class. But they're really supposed to use the pipeline account, and I won't get into the details of why that is, but there's a new law and blah, blah, blah. So these are directions on how to do that. I have them right here. They're not exactly word for word correct where it says things are, because the website has changed, but basic information is the same. And if you're real techy and you master this part, there's directions here on how to forward pipeline to personally. And I'll give you these in the highest update for you. If you have any questions, you can stop by room 13.
Thank you, Lisa. So people who are filling out registration forms, on the back, make sure you put 66015 for the class. 66015. You just check add 66015, okay?
One little side note, being a student for San Marcos City College with drawn credit, you have access to lynda.com, which changed to learning. Anyway, it's tutorials. All these great tutorials on how to do all kinds of stuff.
Okay, so that's really, hey, that's important. You realize that you have free lynda.com now. I don't know what it morphed to, anybody, what is lynda.com now called?
LinkedIn Learning,
right, it was bought by LinkedIn. This is tutorials on video tutorials on everything that would also, ordinarily, it was $40 a month, right? Yeah, for unlimited access, you get it for nothing. What? Yeah, I'm going to in a minute, okay. So you have a pipeline email, which Lisa just told you about. You also have, we also have an email list for this class, and that's the way that I generally communicate with you. So if you are not on our class email list, if you didn't get the two emails I sent out telling you that this class was going to convene, it means you're not on the email list. To get on the email list, you go over here and you put your name and your email, and Robert will put you on the email list. So please make sure that you're on that list if I need to communicate with you in any way. That's the way I'm going to do it.
Yes, Michael.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
You made it. Every Friday after class, some of us get together and meet at the David Bryant Coffee House, two blocks away at Mission and De La Vina, two blocks away that way. And we continue the consciousness vibration. Go a little deeper, maybe take it to the next level, have some humor, have some excitement, maybe a little sadness. There's always something brewing. So, everyone invited?
Good, there's one less announcement that I have to make. I was going to make that announcement. Dina, where are you? Dina Black? Dina?
I attended the Death Cafe in Riverdale. It gave me the idea to start a spirituality cafe. And the other day I did it. It's called the Santa Barbara Spirituality Cafe. And it's based on the idea of small groups where you can discuss your own particular area of spirituality in small groups. So it's a participating way of doing things. And as of yesterday, there are about 18 that signed up. So, and I haven't decided on what date yet, but I'm thinking of a Saturday, like from 2 to 4 or 2:30 to 5, something like that. And all you have to do is look up Santa Barbara Spirituality Cafe and, ask for information. Okay?
So, this is Dina Black. If you want to talk to her in particular about this, find her.
Okay. Oh, you forgot that. When do we have the art thing?
Last class.
Okay. Oh, that looks bad. Now it's bad.
You can announce again next week.
Okay.
Okay, so, yeah, April, Julie reminds me to remind you that we have our art fair at the last session, which would be April 3rd. But I'll announce it when it gets close.
All right.
Did you say that?
No, it's based on the same idea.
No, I know, but we never heard that.
All right, let's officially. Okay, so in the future, I'm going to start class pretty promptly at 10:15.
Yeah.
Okay, for people who are here. So if you would like to not disturb the class by coming in late, get here at 10:15, okay? By sitting here right now, you have either checked your name off on the registration list, or you have filled out a registration form that you are going to give to me or give to the office today. That's the condition by which you get to be a participant in this community. So please make sure that you have done that or that you do that. Next week, Carl Blasius is going to, that gentleman there, who has been a class member for a long time, is going to talk to us about the placebo effect, and especially its surprising use and powerful uses in modern medicine. Is that an adequate way to say it? Yeah?
Neuroscience.
The neuroscience of nothing. No, of the placebo. it ain't nothing, it's a big deal.
Maybe nothing is the key.
Okay, and then in 2 weeks, Mark McGinnis is going to come and we're going to interview him. Mark McGinnis is a legend in Santa Barbara. He's the guy who walks on stilts at the solstice parade. He's also done a couple other things on the side when he's not walking on stilts. Like he founded the Environmental Defense Center, he started Earth Day, etc. He's a professor at UCSB, etc., etc., etc. He's amazing. He's coming in 2 weeks. Let's see. I think that's everything. Okay. We're going to meditate, and then we'll charge into our lesson to the depths and heights, which is going to happen today. But for the meditation, in Buddhism, there are two basic types of meditation. The one we're most of us are most familiar with is mindfulness, open awareness meditation, when you just notice what's happening without getting drawn into it. And that's the one that's diagrammed on the board. That's the one I talked about extensively in class. But there's another meditation that is equally valued in Buddhism, and that is metta, loving kindness meditation, compassion meditation. If this kind of meditation can be looked at as opening the mind, then metta is opening the heart. Now, in fact, you do both in both kinds of meditation, but a frequent criticism of mindfulness, especially when you're beginning it, is it's kind of mental. If you pay attention to where your awareness is coming from, if you're sensitive, you will realize that your awareness is coming from here, this level. It's coming from the brainstem, from the reticular formation. That's what makes you aware. And you can feel that. So your thoughts are above you. You can hear them and see them slightly above your point of view. And you can feel your heart slightly and your guts and your body slightly below your point of view. So it's kind of up here. Whereas in metta meditation, one particularly opens the heart. So you're coming not from here. You're coming from here. You're opening your awareness around your heart. And I think it's a good balance to the kind of higher up point of view that mindfulness generally gives us. So it brings you to a full being kind of openness. So how to do metta? There are various formulae for it. I don't follow any of those, say this, say this, say this, say this. Just really briefly, what you do first is you put yourself, you extend loving kindness to yourself. You put yourself in your own heart, or you flow love from your heart to yourself, and then to people that you are closest to, and then people that you know, and then people in your community, and then people you have issue with that you don't like, that you think are wrong or bad, and finally to the whole world. So that's the kind of sequence that people who systematically do metta do. But I've never been able to do that. It's too systematic for me. What I do is I do mindfulness first. And at the end of my sitting, however long it is, I take a few minutes and I just open my heart to whomever I want to open my heart to. Sometimes to particular people, sometimes to everybody. And at first, when you do this, people that try metta, they say it's kind of it doesn't really feel like love. It's kind of like I'm faking it. But if you persist in doing this, you get a more and more genuine feeling of heart opening and love flowing, and it's really transformative. In terms of the effect of the meditation, there's been significant research showing that people that do metta actually do experience very much benefit from it. It really does seem to be helpful for people. Those of you who know about Matthieu Ricard, the supposedly happiest person in the world, the way he got that title is he did metta, and they saw that the activation in the prefrontal cortex of his brain moved left 4 standard deviations. Nobody has ever shown that much of a left shift. When if we could look at your brain right now, and we could look at the prefrontal cortex, we could tell how happy you were by where you were activated. If you were more activated to the right, you would be less happy. People who are depressed have right prefrontal activation. People who are happier have left prefrontal activation. He, with doing metta, and when he does metta, he doesn't do compassion just for himself or just for another person. He does universal compassion because he's been doing it for so long. He's all the way over here. So that's why he got the label happiest person in the world, by doing metta meditation. Okay, I'll leave it there. Abraham.
Yeah, they also discovered that the heart has 40,000 neurons in it, and the heart can think. So it would be a good idea to teach the mind the wisdom of the heart, if we listen to it.
Actually, I think there are more neurons in that in the heart, a lot more. And I'm not sure that much more than that. Much more. But I'm not sure that the mind, that the heart thinks in the same sense as the mind, but clearly those neurons are there for some reason. Anyway,
Well, would you say something about left brain, right brain in relation to what you're saying about happier is left?
Yeah, not brain. Okay, that's where people make mistake about this. This is prefrontal cortex, a particular part of the brain, okay? So it doesn't conflict with the idea that if you let your left brain shut up and your right brain, like Jill Bolte Taylor says, your left brain shuts up, you're gonna be happier using your right brain. That's a different part of the brain. We're just talking about prefrontal cortex, okay? But don't worry about your prefrontal cortex. The idea is if you do metta, you'll feel better. Yeah, Paris.
Is that anything to do with endorphins?
No, completely different thing, okay? Endorphins have to do with feeling good, but this is seems to be neurological activation for some reason. Okay? I don't know more than that. Bernie.
The pharmaceutical company is working on a pill that will make that happen.
No, but I'm sure you can spend a lot of money on something that will monitor where your frontal cortex activation is. But you don't need it. You just need to do better and you will move left. Okay. Actually, you want a really cheap way to move left? Rent a funny movie and your activation will go left. It just won't stay there. Gordon.
I understand there's also a meditation when you draw in the negative things from another person or world, mm-hmm. and you bring it into your heart and you spit out positive energy for them or your heart.
Actually, it's the other way around, I think.
No, it's not. He's right.
The one that I know about is you breathe in positive energy and you exhale the negative, so that it isn't easy. But no, he's right. You're right. Gordon said it is right, which is you breathe out the positive and you air clean the negative. You're like a cosmic air cleaner.
I've heard of it as a way for pain relief, is that you breathe in the pain and suffering of the world and breathe out.
By the way, I've tried Tonglen. It's way too complicated for me. It's like, what am I breathing in now? When I breathe that, it shifts too quickly. So I don't do it. But I mean, there's a lot of meditation. Anyway, let's sit, because that's not the lesson. That's just getting us set for the lesson of today. You've got a lesson. So here we go. Let's sit for 10 minutes. What I would suggest is you do your normal mindfulness meditation, and then in the last couple of minutes that you try opening your heart to the people you care about, one of whom is yourself. Okay. Just sit for 10 minutes.
It doesn't matter what you just experienced as much as it matters that you took the time to learn to pay attention to whatever you're experiencing. The content of the meditation is less important than the practice and the ability to meditate, that is to be self-aware. And so every time I sit, after I sit, I congratulate myself for having made that non-effortful effort.
Okay. I don't know how to title this class. I keep changing my mind about what the title of it is. But it has something to do with the current way that human beings are thinking about themselves and their world. First. Second, it has something to do with our youth and the way they're experiencing their lives. And neither of those topics is going to be especially positive. So hopefully I'll get enough time at the end to show you a little video that will broaden and lift our perspective. So that's what we're going to try to do today. All right, so here goes. A couple of days ago, I read an article by Peter Russell. Do you know who he is? Peter Russell is, for a long time, he's a physicist and he's a thinker. He's been prominent in transpersonal psychology since its beginnings. He's a really smart, really good guy. I've always respected him and liked to listen to him. Anyway, he wrote an article just very recently called What If There Were No Future? And in it, he argues that not only our civilization, but any civilization that gets to a certain level of technological sophistication is going to learn more and more rapidly, which is going to create more and more change on an accelerating basis, which is going to eventually destabilize that civilization and cause its demise. And there's no way around it. And we're at that point where things are speeding up and destabilizing faster and faster. It's all going to come apart. And it's going to happen sometime soon, like this century, sometime therein. And so what he says at the end of this article is, look, you might as well enjoy the last days and get full value from the fact that it's all over. So I read that article and I went, bummer. Yuck. So then, 2 days ago, I read this on the internet. We're closer to destruction than ever before. The doomsday clock has been reset to 100 seconds to midnight. The world is 100 seconds to midnight, according to the doomsday clock, closer to destruction than at any point since the clock was created in 1947. Each year, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, a nonprofit group that sets the clock, decides whether the events of the previous year pushed humanity closer to or further from destruction. The clock, quote, conveys how close we are to destroying our civilization with dangerous technologies of our own making, end quote, according to the group. This year, the group moved the clock from 2 minutes to 100 seconds to midnight. The closer to midnight we are, the more danger we're in. So that's not very, and that's not very much fun to think that of the 24 hours that would be possible on this clock, we're 100 seconds from the end. And then I thought about the generation that is up in, that coming up now that I teach, called Generation Z, and I thought, what the hell? Why did we call them Generation Z, and how are they standing for it? Generation Z certainly sounds to me like the last generation. What a thing to put on the kids, you know? Then I thought, what's going on here? What are these people, what's being expressed? And from a depth psychological point of view, this is the archetype of the apocalypse. It's an aspect of the deep nature of our minds. And it's not new. You hear the apocalypse being talked about throughout human civilization. It's all going to end. For example, do you remember the Mayan calendar thing? Or Y2K? or the sky is Chicken Little, the sky is falling. So the point is, there is something in us that sees that it's all going to end. Not that it might not all end. We're certainly facing greater challenges than we have maybe ever. But the surety that this is the end is I think, mistaken, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. But where does this archetype come from? An archetype is something in the mind that has to do with universal human experience, things that any human being experiences. And all of us know at some level that we're going to end, that our individual existence is going to end. And to the extent that we're not able to integrate that understanding into our conscious mind, it sits in our unconscious as an archetype, and we project it outward onto other people in the world. So I think this idea that it's all coming to an end for sure is a projection outward of this understanding of each of our individual existences that we're not entirely comfortable with. It's unhelpful in the sense to think this way is unhelpful in the sense that if for sure it's all over, then how can you react to that? Well, you can either deny it and say, "Oh, I'm not even going to think about that. You know, I'm just going to go about my business and get a nicer car." You know, or you go into paralysis, which is, "Well, gee, gosh, I'm scared to death." Or you, you just become fatalistic and you say, "Oh, well, that's the way it is." That's not really very helpful. It doesn't motivate us to do anything about the situation and perhaps prove it untrue. This idea of the apocalypse is hopefully wrong. That is, right now we're in a period of great discovery, great change, and destabilization. It is not necessarily so that this pace, this accelerating change is going to keep accelerating. Maybe we're learning a lot of stuff now that once learned will create a new period of stability on a higher level. You know how that is. In nature, frequently there's a system that's organized and then it becomes superheated or supercharged and becomes disorganized, and then it comes back to organization at a higher level. So maybe we're learning some truths about the universe and ourselves that need to be learned that are really unsettling, but they're in the service of a greater settlement. Also, from the point of view of science, there's just a certain amount to learn. You know, Stephen Hawking said 30 years ago, we're one equation away from solving physics. He was certainly wrong, but the idea is we're learning a lot. There's not an infinite amount to learn. In nature, what we see is we see, rather than cataclysms, we often see periods of change from one migration, change from one order to the next order. We see contraction and then expansion. We see spiraling rather than going out or down infinitely. This idea of the apocalypse, especially the idea that we are, that the progress we're making will cause us to have abilities, powers over the world that we can't control. We'll blow ourselves up, we'll heat ourselves out of existence. We have a technological power that could destroy us. And Russell's saying we'll destroy us. But what this forgets is, or presumes, is that we are constant. We're the same, the people that are getting these powers are the same people that we used to be and that we will be. It doesn't allow for a parallel growth of wisdom, a parallel growth of consciousness. And it's clear that there is a growth of consciousness, that the world is a very changed place. If you don't believe this, listen to Steven Pinker about what they used to think was okay and what we're horrified by now. And the idea that the world is getting worse is a mistaken idea on a lot of levels, and Pinker argues really, I showed you a video of his that argues really strongly against that. We get outraged about stuff that people took for granted, for example, in terms of treating other people. All these things that are happening in society are happening to allow disadvantaged groups to not be disadvantaged. People that were looked down on are now not looked down on. There's a lot of societal change for the better that's happening, clearly. I think there's a race now. I mean, we all think there's a race now between our technological, our power over the physical world and our humanity. And I think humanity is kind of losing the race right now, but I think humanity is going to speed up. And so I think it's quite possible that, as Barbara Marx Hubbard says, the current world crises will serve as an evolutionary driver.
That's right.
And create a human being that is fit for the world that we're creating, a new species, something beyond Homo sapiens sapiens. Wait, let me get through with this, and then we can do all the kind of counter arguments and stuff. So I think a more, because I realize this is something we're all concerned about. So I think a more helpful archetype here than the archetype of the apocalypse, which we are currently throwing around, especially at our youth, is the archetype of birth. Mm-hmm. That is, when you go from one way of being to another way of being, that the experience we've all had of that, of one world ending and another world beginning, is our own birth. And if you believe pre and perinatal psychology, that's something that is at the very deepest level of our individual understanding, of our individual consciousness, even if it's not conscious. It's at some level formative of who we are. And in birth, yes, something is lost, but something else is gained, and there's a difficult passage. It's called a rite of passage, and birth is the archetypal rite of passage. Rick Tarnas says, you know who Rick Tarnas is, the astrologer who, he's come to class several times, he also talked to Mind and Supermind. What he says is, what we're seeing now is the birth contractions of a new world. And this is a very contracted period, like the 60s were an expansive period, and there'll be another expansive period, and hopefully it will be a smooth and successful birth. There's no guarantee of that. But if you operate from the birth archetype, then you do everything you can to create the new world rather than running away from the inevitability of the old world falling apart. So I think that what we want to be doing is, instead of running around thinking this, you know, yelling the sky is falling, I think what we want to be doing is doing everything we can to keep it up there and to paint it a different color. You know? So that's kind of what I wanted to say about not falling into despair mistakenly and unproductively, but rather shifting where you're coming from to realize that you've got a lot to do. We've all got a lot to do now. We've got huge challenges, and we've got an opportunity to create a world, a humanity and a world that's far superior to what we have seen before. Okay, so there were a couple of hints. Bernie was the first, and Paulo was the second. Okay, so and then Ali. We can't do too much talking about this. We can do a little.
Okay,
I'm going to give you the mic.
Isn't what you're saying just a lot of new dance steps until the sun burns out? When the sun burns out, all of the things we've achieved are meaningful.
Yeah. Okay. So the sun's not going to burn out for a while, so I wouldn't worry too much about it. Yeah, if you take the really long view, the billions and billions and billions of years view, then yeah, I'm going to have to find another sun to go to, but by that time we'll be good at going to other suns.
My question, I have a question and a comment. The question is, was this written from the point of view of the disintegration of the human race as opposed to the entire world? Because in a very anthropocentric way, that's the way a lot of things are written. And I'm just wondering about, after almost every extinction event, it does then open up the possibility of great explosions in life, but it might not be human, not even in an advanced stage. And then my only comment is, I kind of agree with you, it's a good cop-out, it's an easy, lazy way to say, let's just pillage and be sybaritic because we can't do anything anyway.
So yeah, Russell's talking about the demise of technological civilization and the fact that it will cause a real lot of havoc for all the other species too, but that it won't extinguish all the species. It's basically us that we're going to blow up, and a world we're going to create that's going to be not harmonious for a lot of living things that currently live. But even if, what Russell said is, even if we blow the whole Earth up, there are a lot of other planets out there that are probably harder than mine. You know? Not very reassuring to me.
Okay, so one more, Ani, and then we gotta go.
I want to applaud you for bringing this up and pointing us in where I believe is true too, that we're at the crisis of birth of a humanity like Elizabeth Satoris, evolutionary biologist, says every species on Earth that has become sustainable has learned that it's cheaper to feed your enemies than to kill them. And that humanity as an adolescent species right now is developing, is evolving to new capacities and consciousness.
I absolutely think so. And okay, so one more, and then we got to kind of move to the next topic.
Our belief system is moving into the direction of believing that we have created our reality. So if something happens to it and it's destroyed, then we can create another reality. We're capable of doing that. And an example of our history, you know, like if you believe what Edgar Cayce came up with, the idea that there was a kingdom called Lemuria, lived before and it was completely destroyed. Then, out of the ashes of that destruction, our civilization was born. So, we're always going to continue doing that. And even if the Earth is blown out, we're going to find another planet to experience that. But of course, there are some souls that are moving beyond that, so they don't have to worry about it.
I'm not addressing that at all. Okay.
All right, so that kind of, this is just something to get you to think, because you hear this doomsday stuff all over the place, and I think it's not productive. It's more than not productive, it moves us in the wrong direction. All right. Now I want to bring us a little bit, I want to be a little bit more mundane. I want to talk about something that's happening right now that is of some concern to us. It's just something we've talked about before. I think it's right now the most important sociological event in human life. And I think that it's, as John Haidt says, it's probably the most important thing that's happened to humanity since we learned to tame fire, which is a big deal. So I've talked about this before, you're familiar with this, but I wanted to show you some new statistics about this and flesh it out a little more. So we need to use this. We don't need to make everything dark yet. I don't think. I think you can read this well enough.
I think I'll do this.
So it'll take me just a moment to pull this up. I'll need it somewhat. It doesn't need to be totally dark, but it needs to be somewhat dark so you can see this. Is Leon here?
Yeah.
Leon, where are you? Okay, so this is thanks. Leon Juskalian. Emails me every once in a while and sends me some really interesting stuff, and what you're about to see is thanks to him. These are two of the emails that he sent to me that I wanted to underline for you. Okay, thank you, Leon.
You are welcome.
Okay, so here we go. All right, so I'm going to read this to you, but I wanted you to be able to see it also. All right, so we talked about this before, the fact that the youth, what?
That means half or not?
Wait, what do you say statistics, okay? This is what's happening is accelerating, so let me show you, okay? So nearly half of American teens are online almost constantly. That's about double what it was 3 years ago. It seems like young people are always online. If it seems like young people are always online, it's because they are. Well, at least that's the case for about half of them. Some 45% of American teens say they are online, quote, almost constantly, end quote, according to a new survey from Pew Research. That number has nearly doubled from the 24% who said they were always online in Pew's 2014-2015 study. The results varied by gender. 50% of girls said they were always online, compared with 39% of boys. So let's look at the statistics here. They graphed them for us really nicely. You see,
2018, almost constantly online, several times a day, less often. 2014, 2015, 24%, 56%, 20%.
Were those the only choices they had?
No. Yeah, they were, because less often includes once a day, several times a week, or less often than that. So they really had a whole range of choices.
They have to be online. They have an iPad in the school.
Yeah, but this is beyond school. I think it's about 7.5 hours beyond school. I'm not sure about that. The statistics will come up here on the next one, I think. Let's go to here. Okay, so what did they use? What platforms did they use? Just so you can get hip. Okay, so here's what they use, folks. 85% use YouTube. 32% say they use that one most often, so that's really popular. Instagram, 72% use it and 15% use it most often. Snapchat, 69% but 35% use it most often. Facebook, 51 and 10, and then Twitter, 32 and 3, and then Tumblr, Reddit, and none of the above, much less. So those are the sites that they're on when you see them walking around blindly semi-navigating the world. Okay. So that's the first one I wanted to show you. Okay. Then I want to go here. I want to go to So this is about teenagers and kids younger than teenagers, and the pros and cons of giving them a phone for Christmas. Okay. I'm not going to read all of this, but some of it. Okay. So how many of you are thinking of giving your tween, that is less than a teen, right? How many of you are thinking of giving your tween a cell phone for Christmas? Because we all know that in the eyes of a tween or a teen, a shiny new cell phone under the Christmas tree is even better than Santa. The pressure is on everyone, and the pressure is on. Everyone at school has a cell phone nowadays. It seems that all the kids at school, on sports teams, scouts, and youth groups, have cell phones. If you don't get your kid a cell phone this Christmas, you're a veritable Scrooge, forcing your child to remain in the dark ages. But before you jump on the cell phone bandwagon, consider the pros and cons. So now we're just going to look at the pros and cons, very well said, of giving your kid a phone. And by the way, this isn't just pre-teenagers and teenagers. Kids get their phones now really young.
Yeah.
All right, the pros of cell phone, giving a child a cell phone. Cell phones facilitate pickups from school and other activities. It also helps with carpooling. Geo-tracking apps allow you to know where your child or his or her phone is all the time. Okay. That might not be good for a child's mental health. Your kids can be in the loop with their peers. Your kids will stop pestering you for a phone. You'll all have a nice Christmas, and they'll love you for about a week. Okay. All right, now the cons. Let's see. These are the cons, okay? The creators of smartphones successfully designed them to be addictive. A survey by Common Sense Media shows that the average teen spends 7 hours and 22 minutes a day looking at a screen. And this time does not include doing homework. Tweens spend about 4 hours and 44 minutes in front of the screen. In fact, 50% of teens feel addicted to their phones, and 78% check their phones hourly. I would say every 5 minutes in my classes. Smartphones result in lower academic grades because they distract kids from their studies and reduce cognitive capability. This is something I didn't know. Smartphones alter the brain. Kids who spend more than 7 hours a day in front of a screen were found to have premature thinning of the cortex,
putting them at risk of deteriorating memory function, perception skills, and cognitive abilities. Smartphones adversely affect the quality and quantity of sleep. Children stay up late on their phones, and they wake up in the middle of the night to check for messages. Sleep deprivation leads to moodiness, depression, reduced focus, and a weakened immunity. Smartphones lead to the deterioration of real person-to-person relationships. Teens tend to become absorbed in their virtual relationships and to neglect their real ones, including their relationships with family members. Multiple studies have shown that social media usage increases the risk of anxiety and depression. Suicide rates amongst teenage girls between 10 and 14 have tripled thanks to the misery caused by social media. About one out of every four children have suffered from cyberbullying, but only one out of 10 will tell their parents. With a smartphone, kids can view pornography anytime and anywhere. Young people are lured to dangerous sites through deceptive and targeted ads. Let's remember that porn sticks in the brain, these images are difficult to erase, and they reduce the possibility of marital happiness.
So just, I'll read the very end of this, which is,
I guess we were born in the right.
If you hold off giving your kid a smartphone, you're not Scrooge. You're simply one of the strong and the few who are doing one of the basic duties of a parent, protecting your children. It's tough love, but real love. And that's the best gift you could ever give your kids.
Where's this from?
Let's bring it up so you can see, you can get it, okay? You can also email me and I can forward it to you. From intellectualtakeout.org. intellectualtakeout.org. But if you email me, if you want this, email me and I'll just forward it. Okay, so let's turn that off now. Okay. Now I want to do one more thing with this topic, which is want to read something to you from Technology Review. Technology Review is MIT Technology Review, it's MIT's magazine, and so it's going to be pro-technology, which is why I was kind of surprised to read this article. This is from the January-February 2020 current issue, and it's the youth issue, it's all about the youth. So let me read just one little article to you here. It's on page 66.
It's not always pro-technology.
Well, it's certainly not in this case. But you would expect it to be pro-technology to some extent. Okay. So what I'm going to do is, can we open these up again a little more? Because I'm not going to need this again for about 15 minutes. So let's open these up so we have a little more light. And I can see what I'm reading. Thank you. All right. I'll get as far as I might not read the whole article, but I'll get as far as I can in 15 minutes. Okay. A few years ago, I performed an experiment in a philosophy class I was teaching. This is college students he's talking about now. My students had failed a midterm test rather badly. I had a hunch that their pervasive use of cell phones and laptops in class was partly responsible. So I asked them what they thought had gone wrong. After a few minutes of silence, a young woman put up her hand and said, quote, "We don't understand what the books say, sir. We don't understand the words," end quote. I looked around the class and saw guileless heads pensively nodding in agreement. Understand, you don't get very sophisticated when you're texting all the time. They don't understand the words in their textbooks.
I use the simplest textbooks I can in my classes, and student after student comes up and says, I don't understand. And these are things that we would be reading in ninth grade. Scary. Okay, I extemporized a solution. I offered them extra credit if they would give me their phones for 9 days and write about living without them. 12 students, about a third of the class, took me up on the offer. What they wrote was remarkable and remarkably consistent. These university students, given the chance to say what they felt, didn't gracefully submit to the tech industry and its devices. The usual industry and education narrative about cell phones, social media, and digital technology, technology generally, is that they build community, foster communication, and increase efficiency, thereby improving our lives. Mark Zuckerberg's recent reformulation of Facebook's mission statement is typical. The company aims to, quote, give people the power to build community and bring the world closer together, end quote. Without their phones, most of my students initially felt lost, disoriented, frustrated, and even frightened. That seemed to support the industry narrative. Look how disconnected and lonely you'll be without our technology. But after just 2 weeks, the majority began to think that their cell phones were, in fact, limiting their relationships with other people, compromising their own lives, and somehow cutting them off from the real world. Here is some of what they said. This is what's interesting, the own words of these students. Quote, believe it or not, I have to walk up to a stranger and ask what time it is. It honestly took me a lot of guts and confidence to ask someone, Janet wrote. Her name, like the others, is a pseudonym. She described the attitude she was up against. Quote, why do you need to ask me the time? Everyone has a cell phone. You must be weird or something. End quote. Emily went even further. Simply walking by strangers, quote, in the hallway or when I passed them on the street, end quote, caused almost all of them to take out a phone, quote, right before I could gain eye contact with them. That is, rather than actually having to meet another person, you whip out your phone and you got something to do. When I go to City College, I arrive at 5:15. People are sitting at the cafeteria there, waiting for the next class. It's weird. They're all looking at their phones. Nobody's sitting with anybody else. There are like 20 tables and there are 20 separate kids sitting, you know, and there's no conversation. They're just looking at their phones. And I told you this, when I walk in the classroom, the light's off, but there's light. I mean, it's dark. The light, I get there at 6 o'clock, the light, you know, it's dark. But there's light in the classroom, not from the overhead lights, the lights of everybody's screen. It's dead silent. Every single person is looking at their screen. Okay. To these young people, direct, unmediated human contact was experienced as ill-mannered at best and strange at worst. James, quote, one of the worst and most common things people do nowadays is pull out their cell phone and use it while in face-to-face conversation. This action is very rude and unacceptable, but yet again, I find myself guilty of this sometimes because it's the norm, end quote. Emily noticed that, quote, a lot of people use their cell phones when they felt they were in an awkward situation. For example, being at a party when no one was speaking to them. The price of this protection from awkward moments is the loss of human relationships, a consequence that almost all of the students identified and lamented. Without his phone, James said, he found himself forced to look others in the eye and engage in conversation. Stewart put a moral spin on it, quote, being forced to have real relations with other people obviously made me a better person because each time it happened, I learned how to deal with the situation better, rather than sticking my face in a phone, end quote. 10 of the 12 students said their phones were compromising their ability to have such relationships. Virtually all of the students admitted that ease of communication was one of the genuine benefits of their phones. However, 8 of the 12 said they were genuinely relieved to not have to answer the usual flood of texts and social media posts. Peter, quote, "I have to admit, it was pretty nice without the phone all week. Didn't have to hear the effing thing ring or vibrate once, and didn't feel bad about not answering phone calls because there were none that I had to answer," end quote. Indeed, the language they used indicated that they experienced this activity almost as a type of harassment. Quote, "It felt so free without one, and it was nice knowing no one could bother me when I didn't want to be bothered," end quote, wrote William. Emily said she found herself, quote, "sleeping more peacefully after the first two nights of attempting to sleep," okay, "sleeping more peacefully after the first two nights of attempting to sleep right away when the lights got shut off." Several students went further and claimed that communication with others was in fact easier and more efficient without their phones. Stuart, quote, "I actually got things done much quicker without the cell, because instead of waiting for a response from someone that you don't even know if they read your message or not, you just called them from a landline, either got an answer or didn't and moved on to the next thing." Technologists assert that their instruments make us more productive, but for the students, phones have the opposite effect. Quote, "Writing a paper and not having a phone boosted productivity at least twice as much," Elliot claimed. "You're concentrated on one task and not worrying about anything else. Studying for a test was much easier as well because I wasn't distracted by the phone at all," end quote. Stewart felt he could, quote, "sit down and actually focus on writing a paper," end quote. He added, "because I was able to give it 100% of my attention, not only was the final product better than it would have been, I was also able to complete it much quicker." Even Janet, who missed her phone more than most, admitted, one positive thing that came out of having a cell phone was that I found myself more productive and I was more apt to pay attention in class. I'm going to skip a couple of things here because I want to get to another section. I'm going to skip to some parents were pleased with their children's phoneless selves. James said his mother, quote, "thought it was great that I did not have my phone because I paid more attention to her when she was talking," end quote. One parent even proposed to join the experiment. But for some of the students, phones were a lifeline to their parents. As Karen Fingerman at the University of Texas at Austin wrote in a 2017 article in the journal Innovation in Aging, this is a study that a professor at the University of Texas at Austin published in 2017. In the mid to late 20th century, only half of American parents reported contact with a grown child at least once a week. So mid to late 20th century, only half of American parents reported contact with a grown child at least once a week. By contrast, she writes, recent studies find that, quote, nearly all, end quote, parents of young adults were in weekly contact with their children, and over half were in daily contact by phone, by text message, or in person. Emily wrote that without her cell phone, quote, "I felt like I was craving interaction from a family member, either to keep my ass in line with the upcoming exams or to simply let me know someone is supporting me." Janet admitted, quote, "the most difficult thing was definitely not being able to talk to my mom or communicate with anyone on demand or at that present moment. It was extremely stressful for my mom." Safety was also a recurrent theme. Janet said, "having a cell phone makes me feel secure in a way. So having that taken away from me changed my life a little. I was scared that something serious might happen during the week, a of not having a cell phone. And she wondered what would happen if someone were to attack me or kidnap me, or some sort of action along those lines, or maybe even if I witnessed a crime taking place, or I needed an ambulance. What's revealing is that this student and others perceived the world to be a very dangerous place. Cell phones were seen as necessary to combat that danger. The city in which these students live has one of the lowest crime rates in the world, and almost no violent crime of any kind, yet they experienced a pervasive, undefined fear. Oh, okay. All right. Just a little bit more. I first carried out this exercise in 2014. I repeated it again last year in a bigger, more urban institution where I now teach. The occasion this time wasn't a failed test. It was my despair over the classroom experience in its entirety. I want to be clear here. This is not personal. I have a real fondness for my students as people. But they're abysmal students, or rather they aren't really students at all, at least not in my class. On any given day, 70% of them are sitting before me shopping, texting, completing assignments, watching videos, or otherwise occupying themselves. Even the good students do this. No one's trying to conceal the activity the way students did before. This is just what they do. What's changed? Most of what they wrote in the assignment echoed the papers I'd received in 2014. The phones were compromising their relationships, cutting them off from real things, and distracting them from more important matters. But there were two notable differences. First, for these current students, even the simplest activities, getting on a bus or train, ordering dinner, getting up in the morning, even knowing where they were, required their cell phone. As the phone grew more ubiquitous in their lives, their fear of being without it seemed to grow apace. They were jittery and lost without them. This may help to explain the second difference. Compared with the first batch of students, this second group displayed a fatalism about their phones. Tina's concluding remarks described it well, quote, "Without cell phones, life would be simple and real, but we would not be able to cope with the world and our society. After a few days, I felt all right without the phone as I got used to it, but I guess it is only fine if it's for a short period of time. One cannot hope to compete efficiently in life without a convenient source of communication that is our phones." Very last paragraph. Paula was about 28, a little older than most students in the class. She'd returned to college with a real desire to learn, after working for almost a decade following high school. I'll never forget the morning she gave a presentation to the class that was even more alternatively engaged than usual. After it was all over, she looked at me in despair and said simply, "How in the world do you do this?" I'll tell you how we do it. We forbid cell phones in class. Some of us collect them. We have little chew things where you can put them. Some of us just stop every 2 seconds when a phone is out and go, "Please remember about your phone." That's what I do. But after a while, the students get used to it. Even if the minute the break comes, the phones are out before they even get up out of their seats. Anyhow, what I'm suggesting to you is that there's an exponential growth in dependence on the phones amongst the youth. And it's happening at the scale of just a few years. Okay, so a couple of comments and then I've got to show us something. So a couple of comments. So I see 1, 2, 3. Okay,
what?
So one is going to go here, and then I've got to move us.
It was on jury duty this week, and we had to sit 2 hours in the jurors' chambers. Guess what everyone was doing? All the adults.
Okay, everybody. Rather than talking to one another.
I totally agree that I think it's totally out of control, but let's pretend for a moment this class is having this lecture 70 years ago. So the parents, would you be talking about television and radio, and people aren't sitting there like talking together like they used to, and singing songs and reading books?
Yes.
When television arrived in Bhutan, family life went out the window. I probably shouldn't have been doing some years ago, actually. Okay, there's one more. Leon was the last person.
So I just wanted to say that MIT Technology Review is not just a print edition. You can subscribe. You get an email in your box every week. Great.
So Abraham, really quick, because I had a something else. Anyways, we're going to type this.
You know, United Nations has classified Finland as the best education that they have, and they asked him why. It says we require that the students check out their cell phone before they go to the class.
Hopefully that's coming. Okay, so now I'm gonna now we gotta have the room darkened, because I'm gonna show you now that I dragged you through the mud. Or at least concern you greatly. I'm going to show you a pretty wonderful video, so you can come out of here with a kind of larger perspective to buoy yourselves through the vagaries of modern life. Okay, so I'm putting on closed caption here also, because it's got an accent, and some people would also like it. This is a TED. This wasn't the big TED conference. This was a conference that TED did with the National Academy of Sciences. So this is an astronomer, a cosmologist, and he's going to talk to you about who you are, really.
We are all atomically connected, fundamentally, universally. But what does that mean? I'm an astrophysicist, and as such, it is my responsibility to trace the cosmic history of every single one of your atoms. In fact, I would say that one of the greatest achievements of modern astronomy is the understanding of how our atoms were actually put together. While hydrogen and helium was made during the first 2 minutes of the Big Bang, the origin of heavy elements, such as the iron in your blood, the oxygen we're breathing, the silicon in your computers, lies in the life cycle of stars. Nuclear reactions take lighter elements and transform them into heavier ones, and that causes stars to shine and ultimately explode, and therefore enriching the universe with these heavy elements. So, without stellar death, there will be no oxygen or other elements heavier than hydrogen and helium, and therefore there will be no life. There are more atoms in our bodies than stars in the universe. And these atoms are extremely durable. The origins of our atoms can be traceable to stars that manufactured them in their interiors and exploded them
you know, all across the Milky Way billions of years ago. And I should know this because I am indeed a certified stellar mortician. And today I want to take you on a journey that starts in a supernova explosion and ends with the air that we're breathing right now. So what is our body made of? 96% consists of only four elements: hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. Now, the main character of this cosmic tale is oxygen. Not only is the vast majority of our bodies made of oxygen, but oxygen is the one element fighting to protect life on Earth. The vast majority of oxygen in the universe was indeed produced over the entire history of the universe in these supernova explosions. These supernova explosions signaled the demise of very massive stars, and for a brilliant month, one supernova explosion can be brighter than an entire galaxy containing billions of stars. That is truly remarkable. That is because massive stars burn brighter and have a spectacular death compared to other stars. Nuclear fusion is really the lifeblood of all stars, including the Sun, and as a result is the root source of all the energy on Earth. You can think of stars as these fusion factories, which are powered by smashing atoms together in their hot and dense interiors. Now, stars like our Sun, which are relatively small, burn hydrogen into helium, but heavier stars of about 8 times the mass of the Sun continue this burning cycle even after they exhausted their helium in their cores. So at this point, the massive star is left with a carbon core, which, as you know, is the building block of life. This carbon core continues to collapse, and as a result, the temperature increases, which allows further nuclear reactions to take place, and carbon then burns into oxygen, into neon, silicon, sulfur, and ultimately iron. And iron is the end. Why? Because iron is the most abundant nuclei in the universe, which means that we cannot extract energy by burning iron. So when the entire core of the massive star is made of iron, it's run out of fuel. And that's an incredibly bad day for a star. Without fuel, it cannot generate heat. And therefore, gravity has won the battle. The iron core has no other choice but to collapse, reaching incredibly high densities. Think of 300 million tons reduced to space the size of a sugar cube. At these extreme high densities, the core actually resists collapse. And as a result, all of this falling material bounces off the core. And these dramatic bounds, which happens in a fraction of a second or so, is responsible for ejecting the rest of the star in all directions, ultimately forming a supernova explosion. So, sadly, from the perspective of an astrophysicist, the conditions in the centers of these exploding stars cannot be recreated in a laboratory. Now, thankfully for humanity, they were not able to do that. But what does that mean? That means that as astrophysicists, we have to rely on sophisticated computer simulations in order to understand these complex phenomena. These simulations can be used to really understand how gas behaves under such extreme conditions, and can be used to answer fundamental questions like, what ultimately disrupts a massive star? How is it that this implosion can be reversed into an explosion? There's a huge amount of debate in the field, but we all agree that neutrinos, which are these elusive elementary particles, play a crucial role. Yeah?
I'm about to show you one of those simulations. So neutrinos are producing huge numbers once the core collapses. And in fact, they are responsible for transferring the energy in this core. Like thermal radiation in a heater, neutrinos pump energy into the core, increasing the possibility of disrupting the star. In fact, for about a fraction of a second, neutrinos pump so much energy that the pressure increases high enough that a shockwave is produced, and the shockwave goes and disrupts the entire star. And it is in that shockwave where elements are produced. So thank you, neutrinos. Supernovas shine bright, and for a brief period of time, they radiate more energy than the sun will in its entire lifetime. That point of light that you see there, which was certainly not there before, burns like a beacon, clearly indicating the position where the massive star has died. In a galaxy like our own Milky Way, we estimate that about once every 50 years, a massive star dies. This implies that somewhere in the universe, there's a supernova explosion every second or so. And thankfully for astronomers, some of them are actually found relatively close to Earth. Various civilizations recorded these supernova explosions long before the telescope was invented. The most famous of all of them is probably the supernova explosion that gave rise to the Crab Nebula. Korean and Chinese astronomers recorded these supernovae in 1054, as they almost certainly Native Americans. These supernovae happened about 5,600 light years away from Earth. And it was so incredibly bright that astronomers could see it during the day. And it was visible to the naked eye for about 2 years in the night sky. Fast forward 1,000 years or so later, and what we see these filaments that were blasted by the explosion moving at 300 miles per second. These filaments are essential for us to understand how massive stars die. The image that you see there was assembled by a Hubble Space Telescope over a span of 3 months. And it is incredibly important to astronomers because it ultimately carries the chemical legacy of the star that exploded. The orange filaments that you see there are the tattered remains of the star and are made primarily of hydrogen. While the blue and red filaments that you see are the freshly synthesized oxygen. So studying supernova remnants like the Crab Nebula allowed astronomers to firmly conclude that the vast majority of oxygen on Earth was produced by supernova explosions over the history of the universe. And we can estimate that in order to assemble all the atoms of oxygen in our body, it took of the order of 100 million supernova. So every bit of you, or at least the majority of it, came from one of these supernova explosions. So now you may be wondering, how is it that these atoms that were generated in such extreme conditions ultimately took residence in our body? So I want to follow this, the thought experiment. Imagine that we're in the Milky Way and a supernova happens. It blasted tons and tons of oxygen atoms, almost into empty space. A few of them were able to be assembled in a cloud. Now, 4.5 billion years ago, something unsettled that cloud and caused it to collapse, forming the sun in its center and the solar system. So the sun, the planets, and life on Earth depends on this beautiful cycle of stellar birth, stellar death, and stellar rebirth. And this continuous recycling of atoms in the universe. And as a result, astronomy and chemistry are intimately connected. We are life forms that have evolved to inhale the waste products of planets. But now you know that we also inhale the waste products of supernova explosions. So take a moment, inhale. An oxygen atom has just gone into your body. It is certain that that oxygen body remembers that it was in the interior of the star and was probably manufactured by a supernova explosion. This atom may have traveled the entire solar system until it splashed on Earth long before reaching you. When we breathe, we use hundreds of liters of oxygen every day. So I'm incredibly lucky to be standing in front of this beautiful audience, but I'm actually stealing your oxygen atoms. And because I'm speaking to you, I'm giving you some of them back that once resided in me. So breathing, participates in this beautiful exchange of atoms. And you can then ask, well, how many atoms in our body once belong to Frida Kahlo? About 100,000 of them. 100,000 more probably belong to Marie Curie. 100,000 more to Sally Ride, or whoever you want to think of. So breathing is not only filling our lungs with cosmic history, but with human history. I would like to end my talk by sharing a myth that is very close to my heart, a myth from the Chichimeca culture, which is a very powerful Mesoamerican culture. And the Chichimecas believe that our essence was assembled in the heavens. And on its journey towards us, it actually fragmented into tons of different pieces. So my abuelo used to say, one of the reasons why you feel incomplete is because you are missing your pieces. But don't be fooled by that. You'll be given an incredible opportunity of growth. Why? Because it's not like those pieces were scattered on Earth and you have to go and pick them up. No, those pieces fell into other people. And only by sharing them, you will become more complete. Yes, during your life, there's going to be individuals that have these huge pieces that are making you feel whole. But in your quest of being complete, you have to treasure and share every single one of those pieces. Sounds a lot like the story of oxygen to me, which started in the heavens in a supernova explosion and continues today within the confines of our humanity. Our atoms in our body have embarked in an epic odyssey with time spans from billions of years to mere centuries, all leading to you, all of you, witnesses of the universe. Thank you.
His name is Enrico Ramirez Ruiz, in case you want to see that again. Our bodies were forged in the clumping of stars. Any quick comment? The take home is that every time you breathe, that right now in your body, you have 100,000 atoms that were once in the body of anybody who ever lived. And everybody who ever lived. And also that we're exchanging them all the time. And also that your basic building blocks, the atoms of your body, they were created at the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, and they've been around ever since. So you really, at some level, very wise, or at least ancient. I meant there are more atoms in your body than there are stars in the universe. 10 to the 27th, that's pretty good. Okay, so I guess we should adjourn for today. Deal with what's going on Earth in a pretty
productive way, but remember that we're larger than that. See you next week.
Thank you for acknowledging.